Good evening. Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengrabe. I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, known as Live from the New York Public Library. As all of you know, my goal here is to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when successful, to make it levitate. It is a pleasure to welcome back Ira Glass to be live from the New York Public Library for, I believe, the third time. Once he was here with Edgar Keret, once with Nico Muley, and tonight he will be joined by Dan Efron and Nancy Updike. Thank you. Upcoming still in November, we have Mary Louise Parker with Mary Carr, and I will be interviewing Edmund de Waal on the 16th of November. In December, the Robert Silvers Lecture will be delivered this year by Helen Wendler. I would like to say a big thank you to the Ford Foundation for their fantastic support of Live from the New York Public Library for its 10th anniversary. To celebrate, the Ford Foundation will match your contribution to Live dollar for dollar when you give. You'll help make sure we continue to engage New Yorkers in conversations that contribute to and enrich the cultural discourse. Please consider giving with the pledge cards which are at the door. Additionally, I would like to thank the continuing generosity of Celeste Bartos and Manaz and Adam Bartos. After this event, Dan Efron will sign his new book, Killing a King, The Assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the Remaking of Israel. Thanks go, as always, to our independent bookstore, 192 Books, for being on hand. On the 20th anniversary of the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, tonight Ira Glass speaks with longtime contributor and producer Nancy Updike to This American Life and her husband Dan Efron, former Jerusalem Bureau Chief for Newsweek. Both have covered Israel for years. Efron was at the rally where Rabin was killed and has written a new book just out about the murder called Killing a King, The Assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the Remaking of Israel, while Updike just created an episode about the assassination for This American Life. Incorporating historical footage from the time of the murder and audio from Updike's program, Ira tonight will lead a discussion about why the assassination still spawns conspiracy theories, public shouting matches, and fierce political divisions. As many of you know, for the last 7 or 8 years, I've asked my guests to give me a biography of themselves in 7 words, a haiku of sorts, or if you're very modern, a tweet. Dan's bio reads as follows. I wrote book, now I need glasses. Nancy's bio, grew up WASP, had questions, became reporter. And Ira Glass submitted to me quite a few and then settled on one, but I will read two. He writes, I may revise, but for now, here's this. Good editor, producer, still doesn't enunciate properly. And then he gave me, as I said, quite a few, but I really love this one, so I have to read it before I bring them on stage to your cheers. I considered this, but I guess it's not really a bio. Only visits the library for Paul's events. Please welcome them.
Scooch together.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the assassination, which was 20 years ago today, We're going to talk about the book and also the radio story. We have video and other things and images that were not on the radio. And just to review just the basic facts for those of you who aren't super familiar with what happened 20 years ago, Yitzhak Rabin was the Prime Minister of Israel. He was assassinated by a fellow Israeli who opposed the peace process that Rabin was at that point trying to make happen, the Oslo peace process. So Ira, this is Dan, this is Nancy.
And just a quick question. How many of you out there heard the radio show that we did about the Rabin assassination? Oh, good, good. You get good special treats afterward. a book. and just to say, we wanted to do this this radio story because here's this tremendous event in this country, and we knew from the reporting that Danny, I'm going to call him Danny. I just can't call him Dan for an hour. did for his book that here was this event that lingered in the country, and we wanted to kind of go in depth and see how is that happening now 20 years later? How is it happening in the lives of the people? How does it exist in the lives of the people who were there that night? And how does it exist in sort of the larger political conversation?
Why don't you talk about it, like how you got involved, why you decided to write a book about this story, like how you ended up down this
path? Yeah, and let me just say, by the way, I wrote parts of this book in this building, in the reading room upstairs. In New York, we live on a studio on the East Side, and when it just got too cramped, I would come here before the reading room came to be under renovation. So it's a nice homecoming. It's nice to be here. The kernel for this book started in 2012. I was the bureau chief for Newsweek in Jerusalem, and I was doing that thing that you do when you want to be really productive. I was clicking on YouTube, click and then click and then click, and eventually, several hours into it, I came across this clip of the interrogation of Yigal Amir, the 25-year-old Jewish extremist, Jewish Israeli young man who had killed Rabin. So this is 2012, so it's about 17 years later. And I found it gripping. The quality was terrible, the audio was so-so, but the clip was gripping, in part because I had been in Israel in the 90s. I'd reported from the rally or at the rally where he was killed.
So 20 years ago tonight, you were at that rally?
That's right, okay. Yeah. It was a peace rally, and it was huge. There were 100,000 people there. And then I covered the trial of Yigal Amir over the course of several months. And so 17 years later, 18 years later, it felt very relevant. And watching Yigal Amir talk to policemen, Yigal Amir sort of disappears into the prison system in Israel. He gets convicted a few months after the assassination. Israelis don't allow journalists into prison to interview him. Seeing him on a computer screen, I found very interesting. And from there, I thought, if there's 20 seconds of it in the world, if that exists, if police went to the trouble, thank you, of taping 20 seconds, they probably taped many hours of it. And I made it my mission to find that tape and to watch it. And eventually I did. And we're going to show you a short clip. This is not the one that I initially saw on YouTube.
Well, and just to say, you watched, 8, 10, 12 hours. Am I getting that right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, all over the course of a long weekend where Nancy thought I was insane. and you'll see why when we see this.
That's Yigal Amir on the right.
So wait, so what did you get from seeing that?
Thank Thank you. Yes.
Well, also, I just had to say, like you know, here in the United States, we think of like the Israeli security apparatus as being this like super high tech, state of the art, and like this is it. It's like they have the camera hidden in a box. You know what I mean? Like with a little hole in it. Like no one will ever think that there's a camera in this box with a hole in it.
This is the good quality, by the way. Yeah, this is the better one. Seriously, you'll see the other stuff.
Okay.
So here's what you get. So well, first of all, let me say, right. So the technique is a little cumbersome because the interrogator who is on your left, he's taking down every word. He's writing down every word that Yigal Amir says
by hand.
Yeah. And in fact, there was a point where the documents came my way as well, and so I had my Hebrew is pretty good. I had a chance to read through them.
In the transcript of this interrogation.
Right, but it's the handwritten transcript. So it took a very long time to get through it and to try to understand it. But what you get is, I mean, you're asking what you get. You get the story, the whole story, of Yigal Amir stalking Rabin over 2 years and eventually catching up to him. And, you know, this interrogator is asking questions that are a lot like what a journalist would want to know. I said that journalists can't get into the prison system to talk to Yigal Amir, but he's asking, you know, the what and the when. He wants to know exactly what Yigal Amir did, when he left his home that night, what he was carrying with him. But he also wants to establish motive and the frame of mind of the suspect. So he's asking, what were you thinking at that moment? When was the first moment that the idea of killing Rabin came to your mind?
And Yigal Amir is in these hours and hours of interrogation. He wants to tell the story. He wants to talk about here's what I did, here's why I did it, and so
he's proud.
He is proud. He is proud. This was what he wanted to do.
It's a patriotic act in his view.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And let's just talk for a minute about what he did, what happened that night. So Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli prime minister, 2 years earlier had signed a peace deal with the Palestinians. This is that awkward moment that you probably remember of Arafat and Rabin being kind of coaxed together by Clinton for that handshake.
On the White House lawn.
On the White House lawn. This is September 1993, and Yigal Amir, who is I think first-year law student at the time, watches this on TV and tells himself right away, this is a betrayal of Israel, it's a betrayal of Judaism. Amir is a Jewish extremist, he's religious, he has studied in ultra-Orthodox schools. Every word of the Torah for him is literal truth. And the fact that this involves giving up parts of the West Bank and Gaza, biblical Israel to him, is a betrayal of Judaism. And then he spends 2 years stalking Rabin, looking in the paper for places that Rabin will be appearing, will be speaking publicly, going to these places, seeing if he can get close enough. And then eventually he does it, and he does it at this peace rally, this very large peace rally, where Amir gets there, he sees Rabin's Cadillac in the parking lot, this armored Cadillac that, in fact, the security service had just bought a few months earlier because they sensed there was a growing threat to Rabin's life. Rabin had driven around in a Chevy Caprice up until then. And he's resisting the idea, by the way, that he needs protection. He's resisting wearing a bulletproof vest. And Amir gets into this parking lot that's supposed to be secure. He waits for Rabin to come down off the stage after the rally. He watches him come down with his bodyguards. He circles around him. There's an opening behind him between the two bodyguards, behind Rabin. And Amir reaches for his Beretta. He's got a 9mm Beretta that he keeps with him everywhere. He keeps wedged in his pants and manages to let off three shots. Two bullets hit Rabin in the back, and a third bullet hits the bodyguard. Let's watch the other interrogation. This is the first one I saw. This is the one on YouTube. And you're not it's hard to see, but look for Amir on the left side in the shadow, and then there's three or four policemen interrogating him on the right side.
זה כל מה שעשיתי. No, I can't say. Yo sé, ¿verdad?
¿Qué?
Ella Biglal. Jovatia Tatit.
Yeah, so what Amir is saying is, I did the things that I did because of my religious obligation. And there's this moment here where he says to the interrogator, to the police interrogator, did you take that down? Did you get that? And the guy on the right, who's in the white shirt, he's sort of balding. He's the guy who's taking everything down by hand.
And one of the things that made us want to do a radio story about this is because so much of what happened is documented. You know, there are these you know, primary source materials to go to, like these hours and hours of video and audio, and also because this happened only 20 years ago.
Everybody's alive.
Most people are alive. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, and it's rare that you can have that. You can have all of this documentation. You can go to the people who said this at the time, and they're still alive, and go talk to them about, well, what do you think now? And also Israel, as some of you may know, it's a small country. It's a very informal country. People are listed. You can just kind of, you know, look people up in 411 and get their number, and you know, call them up, and they'll say, "Hey, yeah, come on over. I'm in my shorts. this actually happened to us." And so we found the guy in the white shirt who's doing this interrogation. And this, by the way, is the interrogation that is happening right after the assassination. This is in the hours after it's just happened. And so Danny found this guy, because you can't really see it in this part of the video, but in other parts of the video he's smoking a pipe, and just not a lot of pipe smokers in Israel. I mean, I think he's the only one either one of us had ever met.
Never met a pipe smoker.
And so he went back and talked to people.
And his name was Holmes. Sherlock Holmes.
Exactly. And he had a little watch cap. So Danny went back to people who were, you know, policemen, security at the time, and said, "Hey, you know, there was this interrogator who smoked a pipe," and everybody said, "Oh, well, that's Motzi Naftali, because he's the only one any of them had ever met too."
He's also a windsurfer, by the way. We learned that, yeah. And I think on the first time we called him and said, "Can we come over?" He said, "Not today, because the wind is good, and I'm going to be windsurfing today."
The wind is good. Also speaks many languages. He's a very interesting guy. So talking to him was completely fascinating. He'd been a policeman for a while when Rabin was shot. And when he starts interrogating Yigal Amir, neither one of them knows yet that Rabin has died. They know he's been hit, but they don't know that he's dead. And in the video, Motzi looks very calm. You know, he's an experienced interrogator. He's talked to murderers before. That's not new. But he, as he told us in the interview, he is very much struggling to keep his cool. He's talking to this man who just shot the prime minister, and he, even though he's a policeman, is in shock, just like many other people in the country. And he's also struggling to keep his cool because the person he's interrogating is so pleased with himself. He's almost giddy with the triumph of even just having hit Rabin.
Incredibly calm.
And calm.
And I think this is the thing that stood out. You asked about, you know, what was interesting. In these 20 seconds, you see how calm he is when outside. You know, think of the Kennedy assassination. The country is in a state of trauma and shock. There is no tradition of political assassination in Israel until that point. And to the extent that anyone imagined it would ever happen, I think people thought about a Palestinian gunman, not a fellow Israeli and a fellow Jew.
So Naftali is trying to keep his cool during this interrogation, to be calm and polite, and this is what he told us.
One of my police came in and brought me a cup of tea with a kalkar, white kalkar, you know, this
styrofoam cup.
Yeah. And I told to him, would you also like a cup of tea?
He says that to Egal Amir.
Yes. And I told him, bring another one, please. And he brought him the cup of tea. And he says, don't you have cookies? And I told him, oh, you are pushing your luck.
Can you guys understand? Okay, it's a little bit of an echoey room.
Did
in the back,
hear
can
that?
You hear us? Okay. Okay, good. All right.
There's more.
Let us know if it's hard to hear.
I remember his reaction when I told him, when I accuse him, and I tell him, Moti Naftali accuse you that you shot the prime minister and you caused his death. And he was shocked to hear it. He said, what? Did he die? Wow, and he jumped like your team make a goal.
Like your team scored a goal in a soccer game.
Yeah. And this moment, you want to come and punch him in the face. But you must be correct. You must sit down. Sit down, Egal. Would you like a cup of tea? Let's make l'chaim, he said.
Let's make a toast.
Let's make a toast.
Yeah. L'chaim means to life.
To make
a toast to life.
Yeah, to life. To life that he took.
Could you guys understand the last part? Yeah, okay. So you talked to him, you talked to lots of people who were there and were close to the assassination, then you also found all kinds of documents, right?
Right, and already I have to say that, you know, this felt unusual to me. This felt like more than the kind of thing that you usually get access to. Video where you see the protagonist and you see him over the course of hours and you get a real sense for him. And then, you know, being able to find people through this video who were there, who were, you know, people who were part of this historical moment. But the other element here was a whole trove of documents that I had a chance to read through. And it was so many documents, it took about a year to get through everything. And this is a lot of the investigative file, a lot of the documents that the police interrogators are generating. So this is how it works. When there's a murder or another crime, police will put some number of investigators on the case, let's say 20 or 30 in the case of the killing of Rabin. And every time any one of those investigators does anything, makes a phone call, talks to a witness, they will write a memo to the file. You know, somebody might say, Egal Amir's friend, who knows him well from the university, I called her, I wanted to invite her down to the precinct to talk to us tomorrow, but she can't make it, so she's coming next week. That goes into the file. Some of the documents we saw included mundane things like that. But then there were things that really got to the character of Egal Amir. And I'll show you one of them that I found intriguing. This is written by the lab technician who took Egal Amir's fingerprints. And if you look at the date on the left side at the top, it says 4/11/95 is Israelis reverse the numbers. They write the day first, and then the month, and then the year. So this is the 4th of November. This is exactly 20 years ago tonight, the night of the assassination. And the lab technician, so probably 15 or 20 minutes after the shooting, Egal Amir is brought into the lab, and the technician says to him, put your fingers down on the ink pad. And as Egal Amir is putting his fingers down, he sees that his watch is missing. And he says to the lab technician, and this is what the technician is writing here in the memo. He says to him, my watch is missing, and it's a really nice watch, so can you radio, I think it probably fell off in the parking lot when I was shooting Rabin. can you radio back there, because there are policemen still there, see if they can pick up my watch and bring it back to me.
It just reminds me of when I was a kid, it was explained to me that the definition of chutzpah is a child who shoots his parents and then pleads to the judge to have mercy because he's an orphan.
Right, right.
What else did you find?
Well, so let me just, there's another memo, we don't have it here, but there's another memo written by Moti Naftali, the interrogator we just heard, who describes this moment where Amir raises his hands and says, I did it, and describes his own reaction to it, just being appalled by it, but trying to contain himself and maintain some composure. This is a letter this is a letter that Yigal Amir wrote from prison.
It's in English.
It's in English, right. And this is some months later. But this letter he wrote from prison right around the time of the Israeli election. It was the first election after the assassination. It takes about 6 months for Israelis to then go to the polls and have a new election. And the candidates are Shimon Peres, who was the foreign minister under Rabin, and then the heir to Rabin's position. He becomes the prime minister. And he's competing against this young, fairly new politician, Benjamin Netanyahu.
Who isn't doing so well at the time, partly because he's been in America too long, and he's sort of too American. Like he's that's getting in his way a little bit in terms of connecting with Israeli voters.
Right, he makes his mark here on the talk shows. He's very good at being a guest on a talk show and making Israel's case eloquently. But in Israel, the politics are just much more fierce. And he has a hard time in this transition. Anyway, Amir writes this letter, and he's writing it. He's addressing it to American Jews. And by the way, I was surprised that Amir speaks English well. Amir, it turns out, and I think I didn't really get this sense when I covered the trial in 95. He's a very smart young man. Went to some of the best religious schools in Israel, well-known seminaries, a well-regarded military unit. So he says here, he's making this appeal to American Jews, Orthodox Jews in America, to come to Israel to assert their right for immediate citizenship, and then to vote in the election and to vote for Netanyahu and not for Peres in order to save the country, as he frames it.
What did you learn about him that you didn't know besides the fact that he was smart? I mean, you covered the trial, so you saw him day after day in the trial.
So I think that was one big part of it, that he is not from the margins of society, because I think that was the impression for people who kind of lived through that assassination, and even for people who covered the trial, that he was maybe a ruffian. That he, you know, Israelis talk about this term, a wild weed or a stray weed, someone who maybe wasn't criminally insane, but also wasn't normative, wasn't from kind of normal society.
He's like a little crazy, like that was the reputation he had.
Yeah. And in fact, that is not true at all. He was a smart young man. He was a law student. He had plotted this thing very meticulously. And I think, you know, this is important because I think we have a tendency to do this here as well. When something horrific happens, I think our mind, the first thing we think about is, this guy is crazy. And I think when you do that, you sort of exempt yourself from asking the tough questions about your own society. What is it about your own society, or the education system, or the other elements that incubated this young person? That was one thing. I think the other thing I learned that was surprising was just how calm he was, and I think I came to understand that Amir, defies the odds by killing Rabin. You know, being able to get into that parking lot in the first place, Israel's Secret Service is very well regarded. And then being able to spend 40 minutes without being approached and being able to pull out his gun.
Well, one of the things that you say in the radio story is that Amir said, I'm just going to go to the location, and if God wants me to kill him, the way he'll give me that sign is that he'll give me an opportunity to.
Right.
And so when he walks right by him and the two guards open up, he's like, oh, okay, thank you for that sign. I will go and kill him now.
And so when he's being interrogated, he now believes that God helped him or God allowed him to kill Rabin. And I think that explains, you know, the watch. And it explains raising your hands and saying, I did it. And it explains that sort of emotionless posture that he has.
Well, he's a sane person who thinks that this is what the country needs if Israel is to survive, if the Jews are to survive in the Middle
right.
East.
Well, and also the fact that he survives the assassination is to him further proof that,
or that he doesn't get killed by the security.
That God right. wanted him to do it and that God protected him. Because he went fully expecting to die, and he was okay with dying to accomplish this. But he didn't want to fail, and that's why he was saying it, he said you know, if anyone had come up to me, any security person had come up to me in the 40 minutes that I was waiting at the bottom of those stairs for Rabin, if anyone had come up to me and said, hey, who are you? What are you doing here? I would have left, because he didn't want to be arrested and just sort of, you know, for nothing. But he was prepared to die, and when he didn't die, this became further proof. This is what God wants.
I think spin through. I know you have the photographs
yeah.
of him, like, so, just so people can see, because it's like,
yeah, this is Yigal Amir as a young, you know, as a boy. And I should say, there's a point where I interviewed the family and then interviewed his brother. His brother is convicted as a co-conspirator in the murder, Haggai Amir. And spends 16 and a half years in prison, and then comes out of prison in 2012, right around the time that, you know, I was clicking on YouTube. And was willing to be interviewed, in part because he, like his brother, they're both very, very proud of what they did. They feel they saved Israel from this catastrophe of a Palestinian state and of giving up the West Bank, or parts of the West Bank and Gaza. So he was happy to talk about it. The family was happy to share photos and to talk about Yigal Amir. Remember, we talked about the unit that he was in. He served in an infantry unit.
Which one is he?
He's the guy, the third from the left. He's got a kind of a half smile on his face, and his head is tilted a little bit.
And is this an elite group, or like, what is this, an ordinary group?
It's well regarded as Golani infantry unit.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, it's not you know, it's not a particularly elite unit in the military. Notice that these guys are mostly wearing skull caps. I think he was in a unit primarily with other religious Israelis. And this is another one here, also from the army.
Oh. Okay, so that's the assassin, and the way your book is structured, it's a profile of both Rabin and Amir as their lives are kind of coming together to intersect on that night 20 years ago. Talk about Rabin. One of the things I didn't realize until you started working on this story for the radio was like what a tough guy Rabin was, and super tough for the Palestinians. He was the general who won the Six-Day War, which I didn't know until we started working on this.
Right.
Yeah, walk us through like him a little bit.
Yeah, I'll start and maybe jump in, Nancy. But
wait, I have to get a phone call.
Yeah.
Is that someone's actual phone that they could stop from making noise? Oh my God, it's my own mother. Oh my God. Mom, I'm sorry.
Here, let me here, I can show you how. Helen, I can upturn. Okay. Okay.
I just want to say, in defense of my mother-in-law, this is a new phone.
It's a new phone. It's a new phone.
And it's It's tricky. It's tricky. You know, silent or vibrate. It's totally understandable.
Okay. So he won the Six-Day War. Like, one of the things that I wonder, since the Six-Day War is where a lot of where a lot of that territory was taken, did he have the feeling of like, well, I'm the general who won this land, and so like, I totally am the person who would know when is the right time to give it back, negotiate it away.
Yeah.
Did he have that feeling?
Well, let's go back a little bit. Rabin is kind of a military man for the first three decades of his life. In some ways, he's a military man throughout his life. You know, I think this is the way he comes to think of himself. And he rises to head the entire army. In 1967, he leads the army in this war, the Six-Day War, where Israel captures the West Bank and Gaza. Now, the war sets off this fervor among Israelis, certainly among religious Israelis, but I would say among a lot of secular Israelis as well, this feeling that there was a divine hand in this victory, that Jews were coming back to the places that are talked about in the Bible. Even, you know, among religious Jews, there is a kind of messianic sentiment that is unleashed. This is the beginning of the redemption. But among secular, and Rabin is, you know, I think Dennis Ross writes in his memoir, Rabin is the most secular Israeli I have ever met. Rabin's favorite food is shrimp. one of his, which is not kosher for anyone who doesn't know. One of his advisors told me this story about...
I love this story.
A trip to Egypt that they took, an official trip to Egypt, and the Israeli aides are communicating with the Egyptian aides about the menu and you know what should be on the menu and what shouldn't. And he explains that because it's an official trip, it's an Israeli delegation, the food needs to be kosher. And they agree that the best thing to do is to serve fish because it's easier, you don't have to deal with the milk and the meat. And they get there, and the Egyptians pull out a beautiful plate of couscous topped with shrimp. And Rabin sits at the table, and the aide who told me the story is sitting next to him. And then next to that aide is, I think, the attorney general. And he is the one man in this group of aides of Rabin's who's religious, who wears a skull cap. And Rabin, this aide tells me, keeps wanting to get a little piece of the shrimp, and he's asking the aide lean forward a little bit so that the attorney general can't see me. I mean, all that is to say, Rabin is not infected by this sentiment. You know, some secular Israelis like, you know, Moshe Dayan, the famed defense minister with the patch on his eye, the war hero, actually is. He's very secular, but this idea of Israel returning to the land, of the Jews returning to the land of the Bible, becomes, you know, very important to him. Not to Rabin. Rabin is about security, all about security. And he's very tough on the Palestinians. He's not a peacenik. You know, there's a Palestinian uprising in the late 80s, the first Palestinian uprising. Rabin is the defense minister and orders a very aggressive crackdown against the Palestinians. But at the same time, and I think this is this turning point for Rabin, he comes to understand that Israel's military rule over millions of Palestinians just can't work. It can't be squared with democracy. It's toxic for Israeli society.
In his view.
He doesn't talk about it in humanitarian terms. He doesn't say it's not fair to the Palestinians. That comes later. But he does say already in the 80s, he uses this word that very few Israelis are willing to utter even today. He says apartheid about the future of Israel if Israel's rule over the West Bank and Gaza continues. I've talked too long. Let's see some of these slides. Let's go back to here. So Rabin gets out of the army in 1968, I think a year after the 67 war, and he becomes the ambassador to the United States. This is him being interviewed on Meet the Press. Who is that?
Lawrence Spivak.
Spivak, okay.
We found that out over the course of doing some of these talks. People helped us identify him.
This is 1970. The president is Nixon. Rabin and Nixon form a very warm relationship, and Nixon has him over to the White House quite a lot because he's, he wants to consult with Rabin about the Vietnam War. And Nixon also, Rabin also becomes...
Right, because he's a successful general.
Exactly, huh. Right. Kissinger as well. Rabin becomes quite close to Kissinger. So this is now years later. This is when Rabin is the prime minister. His relationship with Clinton does not begin well. There probably aren't, two world leaders who could be more different. Rabin, terrible at small talk, just a gruff man, not charismatic. Clinton, terrific at small talk, very charismatic. Clinton never served in the military. The first meeting with them is very awkward. Eventually, it becomes very warm, and Clinton talks about Rabin as a father figure. In this picture, Rabin comes to a ceremony with his advisors in Washington. And, we talked a little bit about this. Israel is a very informal country.
So Clinton is fixing his tie?
Well, so
even more than that.
Yes.
Yeah. No, you tell it.
You guys really are married.
This is a black tie event. Rabin shows up not in a tuxedo. And Clinton sees this and points to his bodyguard, who is in a tuxedo, and says, take off the bow tie, give it to this gentleman. And then Rabin doesn't know how to tie a bow tie. So Clinton kind of leans in and helps him. So this is the Nobel Peace Prize. Why don't you talk about this?
Well, look at Rabin's face. that was his face a lot. But part of what's going on here is the person in the middle is Shimon Peres, and Peres and Rabin are lifelong political rivals. And there's all this sort of, scuffle behind the scenes before the peace prizes are given. Is it going to go to Rabin? Is it going to go to both of them? Is it going to, how is this going to work? And finally, it does go to both of them plus Arafat. And Rabin is grumbling about this just all the way up to the last minute of stepping out on stage. Like, I don't need to share this with Peres. Come on. So his face is indicative of his mood.
And Peres, the man in the middle, is the guy who then, when Rabin is assassinated, becomes prime minister. We'll talk about that later. This is... it is funny. This is Rabin and King Hussein. One of the things that happens after the signing of the Oslo deal is that the Arab world starts opening up to Israel. Jordan, a year after Oslo, signs a peace treaty with Israel. Peace treaty that is held up, by the way, through very difficult times, including the period of the Arab Spring and periods of Israeli raids on Gaza and wars and suicide bombings and so on. King Hussein is also a military man, and they have this in common, and they become very close. They are also both chain smokers. Rabin smoked more than two packs a day. And in fact, we had a chance to read the pathology report that was written after Rabin was killed. And one of the things a pathologist says, the pathologist will look at every inch of the body, and one of the things he noticed is that Rabin had, yellow stains between his middle and index fingers on both hands. Hmm. Which I have to say, you were a smoker a long time ago.
yes.
That, I remember.
You're committed. Yes. When you're doing it both hands, when you're an ambidextrous smoker,
yeah.
You are committed.
So this is not a very interesting picture. We chose it because this is Rabin on the second man from the right with the glasses. And this is a ribbon cutting ceremony. And remember, we talked about Yigal Amir stalking Rabin over 2 years and looking, scouring the newspapers, looking for these public events where Rabin would show up and give a speech. So this is one of them. And this comes from Amir's confessions. He talks about this idea that he had read that that Rabin was going to come to this ribbon signing ceremony. He showed up that morning. It wasn't far from Amir's house. Amir lives in Herzliya on the coast. He shows up and Rabin isn't there yet. He gets back into his car. He drives around, comes back, and by then this ceremony has already taken place and the moment is over.
Okay. So one of the things I was surprised to learn when we started talking about this doing this as a radio show, and when you were explaining to me, knowing not much about current Israeli politics, was that people still argue about the Rabin assassination in Israel, and that like you told me that it came up in a pre-election debate. You're just like watching TV, and then the politicians just started just now, a couple months ago, and people started arguing about
election.
Rabin.
And
can I ask you to explain to us here, like, what is the fight about? Like, how does the left see it? How does the right see the assassination? Like, what's the beef?
You want to take left? I'll take right.
Okay. I guess I'll start since it's left. Right. So the left in the immediate aftermath of the Rabin is from the center left. Right. His Labor Party is left of center, and this peace deal is a peace deal that is that comes from the left, and Israel is polarized. In the mid-90s, in some ways divided right down the middle between people who support the peace process and are ready to give up...
Almost 50-50, the polling
almost
is.
Almost 50-50, yeah. Mm-hmm. And people who say, no, this is either for security reasons or for religious reasons, it's not going to work. So when Rabin is assassinated, I think there's a very strong feeling on the left that while one man pulled the trigger, Yigal Amir, that there was this campaign leading up to the assassination.
Like a campaign of hate against Rabin.
Of hate and violence, or let's say violent rhetoric. And there really, you know, there were protests and demonstrations against Rabin. They became rowdy and ugly at certain moments. Rabin was portrayed as Arafat in posters, dressed in a keffiyeh, dressed in an SS uniform, portrayed as a Nazi. You know, there were
people chanted "Death to Rabin." Rabin is a murderer. It was very, very personal and aggressive. Yeah.
So the left says, "Yeah, Yigal Amir is the shooter, but all of you had a hand in creating this atmosphere that led to the murder."
And I know only because you put this on the show that after Rabin is killed, within months, the right takes power. And they've been in power for most of the 20 years since. So basically, Amir wants to kill the peace process and put the right in power. And so this assassin basically gets what he wants, and that's the left's.
Right.
Yeah. And the right?
Well, and the right is very irritated by what they see as a sort of annual pity party that the left throws for itself around the Rabin assassination, and says, "Look, you on the left have lost almost every election fair and square for the last 20 years." So don't keep bringing up the Rabin assassination like this is the one thing that is responsible for this. You know, you guys want to put it all on that because you're too scared to face your own diminishing power in Israel. That's the
and at the heart of the debate is partly. Like, would Rabin have succeeded? Like, if he had lived, would the history of Israel gone differently? Would they have gotten a peace process? And I know the right in Israel says that the peace process never had a chance. The Palestinians weren't good partners. One of the reasons why the peace process fell apart is because of the suicide bombings in Israel. And Israelis are just like, you can't trust these people. We don't want to deal with them. And the right says basically that was all going to happen anyway, Rabin alive or dead. Like when looked at 20 years later, when you looked at this for your book, like, did you have a sense of, like, would it have been different if he had lived?
Oh, you want the answer to that.
Do you even think about that question? Like, how do you even, like, evaluate?
Yeah, look.
Because the left is saying it would have been different. The right is saying it wouldn't have been different.
Let me start by saying this. I think the shooter, Yigal Amir and Haggai, both absolutely felt that what they were doing was changing the course of history. I'm not trying to dodge the question. I will answer, okay. You know, as best as we can, you know, from the perspective of 20 years on. But let me just read, and this is why the book is titled "Killing a King." Haggai is the brother. Remember, he's the co-conspirator. They're very close. They grow up in the same room. They talk a lot about their political feelings, and they plot the murder together over these 2 years leading up to the assassination. And then Haggai writes letters from prison in the weeks after the assassination. And in one of the letters, he's trying to explain to people why he and his brother did what they did. And he sort of puts it in the context of this long arc of Jewish history, you know, of prophets and kings. And remember that these two brothers studied in seminary and in ultra-Orthodox schools. They know certainly parts of the Torah by heart. They know scripture very, very well. And Haggai says in one of the letters, according to Judaism, killing a king is profoundly significant. Killing a king is profoundly significant. He's referring to Rabin, of course. It affects the entire nation and alters its destiny. I read this about 17 years later. It certainly rang true to me. In a prescient, and I have to say even chilling sort of way. I think Israel definitely became a different country that night, a different country. The tougher question is, would peace have succeeded if Rabin had not died? And it's a very difficult question. And to be honest, to give an honest answer, we don't know. We don't know, because when an event like this, you know, sort of kicks history off its course, it's very hard to then try to piece together what would have unspooled if the event had not happened. And I know it's not a very satisfying answer, but I will say this. I remember that era. I remember the Rabin years, and they were very hopeful years. You know, one of the things that the Oslo process entailed was joint patrols between Israeli and Palestinian security people. They would get in the same Jeep and they would drive around the West Bank and Gaza. This today, for anyone who follows news in Israel, is just unfathomable. And dialogue groups. The process was fresh and people were excited. And I think there was hope at the time, probably more hope than at any time in the past 20 years. And I fear maybe more hope than at any time going forward. And mainly because in 1995, the process had not been poisoned yet by the years and years of violence, wars, suicide attacks, settlement expansion, which for Palestinians causes this shrinking of the territory that they hope where they hope to create their state. So that's the answer. We don't really know, but it was a very hopeful time, and I don't remember a period since then that has been as hopeful.
I mean, one of the things that we talked about, and one of the things I know some of your interviewees talked about, was comparing it to other assassinations and in its effectiveness. I can't remember who it was who talked to you about this, about if you compare it to, like, assassinations of other world leaders. Nancy, do you just want to explain this? It was interesting to think about.
Yeah. A political assassination is not... It's not a given that that it will be effective
in changing policy or changing a nation's course.
Yes. I mean, Martin Luther King was assassinated, and I think within a week the Fair Housing Act was passed, and
civil rights continued and expanded.
Yes, with some slowdowns, but so. As we were reporting this story, there's some superficial similarities between the Rabin assassination and the Kennedy assassination. There are conspiracy theories that followed in the wake of the Rabin assassination, and they still exist today. But as we talked, we thought, wait a minute, you know, is it more like the Lincoln assassination? Not that Rabin is Lincoln, not that Israel is the United States. These historical comparisons are kind of only as useful as they go.
Lincoln was very tall.
It was very tall.
Rabin was 5'6".
He was quite short. But they're both young countries, divided over a fiercely held issue that was pulling the country apart. Somebody was elected, a leader was elected, who was part of one side of this debate, and he was killed by somebody from the other side. And there's definitely this idea, I think, I mean, on the right, but also on the left, that if Oslo didn't survive after Rabin, it would have died anyway. It should have had enough, you know, koach, enough strength to survive even Rabin's death. And this was something that we ran by. We talked to a couple of Lincoln scholars about, you know, hey, we're sort of thinking about these things. Are there similarities here? And what do you think about this? And I mean, do you want to talk about how that kind of came around?
So Harold Holzer is sort of the preeminent Lincoln scholar. We don't know anything about Lincoln. We read a book. So we wanted to go to someone and just make sure that this is not completely off the deep end as a comparison. And comparisons, you know, historical comparisons are very risky, so we're treading carefully here. But, you know, one of the questions in my mind was, Lincoln's assassinated, his legacy survives, Rabin's assassinated, and peace, the momentum just gets sucked out of it almost right away, within a few months. And, you know, in the back and forth between Nancy and me, and then later with Holzer, this idea emerged that, you know, Lincoln manages to win the war, right? A week earlier.
A week before he's killed.
A week before he's killed, General Lee surrenders. Rabin has not managed to win the peace by the time he dies. And this is kind of the pivotal difference. And let's just hear what Harold Holzer says about this very idea.
I think without Lincoln, the national will doesn't have an advocate. The will of the people to keep the system that they had created so uniquely and so successfully evaporates. I think without that leadership, the fate of the United States as a future world power is seriously questionable. But, you know, I think his leadership is unique, and if not for his will and his way of expressing national purpose, it's a whole different ballgame.
So, I mean, you know, this is a small part of a much larger conversation, but basically he was saying, look, timing really matters, and if Lincoln, he was saying, you know, we can't know because this isn't what happened. But if Lincoln had been assassinated at almost any other point, almost right up to when he's reelected, that things might have gone differently. It's not that things were inevitable here for some reason that they weren't inevitable with Oslo. That timing of an assassination absolutely matters in what happens afterward.
And when he talks about Lincoln being a unique leader, I think that it was very clear that Rabin was unique in similar ways. He was a military man, a man of war, a man of with this war record, who was making peace. And I think that made him uniquely able to address the fears and concerns, the security concerns of Israelis when it, you know, he was the guy who captured the West Bank and Gaza. So for him to say Israel can now afford, from a security perspective, to give them up or give parts of them up, was very, very hard to challenge Rabin on that issue.
So let's very quickly, like in the time we have left, you brought all this material, videos and other things that that weren't on the radio and that were kind of fascinating. Can we just like go to the very, just quickly kind of whip through some of these?
Yeah.
The first being this reenactment video.
Yeah.
Explain what this is.
Yeah. This is something that the police and Shabak, Israel's FBI, did with Yigal Amir a few weeks after the assassination. They took him back to the scene of the killing and had him reenact it. And they did it in the middle of the night. It's like 2 or 3 in the morning because they didn't want a lot of people around. They were afraid somebody might try to kill him. And so we have this clip of Yigal Amir reenacting the assassination, and he's before what we're about to show you, he's sort of being a movie director. He's very into it. He's like, okay, you stand over there. No, you're a little bit more to the right. You over here. He's very again, very self-possessed, very calm, and very happy to do this, to reenact this moment.
Okay, let's see that.
It's a very short clip. It's from an Israeli documentary, so you'll hear a voiceover.
אדם בודד הצליח לראות בראש הממשלה שהיה שמור על ידי 3 מאבטחים אישיים.
So that's him in the middle. He's wearing body armor with the white vest is body armor, which Rabin was not wearing. And the
Rabin
man
didn't wear the night of the assassination. Yeah.
Yes, right. But also never wore. And the man in the red and black checked shirt, who is the stand-in for Rabin in this scenario, is the interrogator you saw in the very first video, now repurposed.
And you also have video shot of the actual moment. Like now that we've seen this, where you can kind of see how people are moving around.
Yeah.
So this is a video shot by somebody.
It's amateur footage. The time when the assassination happened was the news cameras had left the rally. The rally was the big story.
This was just
Rabin walking down the stairs. So all we have is this amateur footage, and it's very dark. It's at night. So there's a circle to show you where Amir is in this video. And you know, people have said, oh, so this is, you know, this is Israel's Zapruder film. Yes and no. The Zapruder film, it's actually beautiful in a terrible, terrible way. You see Jackie Kennedy's expression. Everything is very bright. You see what happens. What you see in this one is that you don't see in the Zapruder film is the Prime Minister and his murderer so close that they're in the same frame.
And of course, this is before cell phones with cameras, and this is taken on a camcorder by just a guy with a camera.
It's a Yigal Amir in the circle. Rabin is bald man in the center.
Rabin is wearing glasses. You can see them sparkle occasionally. He's got a tie on. And there's a man behind him who's not the shooter, who's a journalism student. We'll talk about him in a second. And there it is.
It's crazy how close he gets.
This is one of the things that made the assassination so hard to you know, to sort of digest for the country, and for people who are, you know, believe in conspiracy theories, it was one of the things that, you know, how could this have happened? How did, you know, unless this was planned, how could this guy get so close to the prime minister? You know, where was the security? How did this happen?
Now, one of the people who was close to the assassination was this guy named Harnoy. Is that how you say his name?
Shlomo Harnoy.
Yeah, explain. You wanted to watch the video with him. Explain what happened when you suggested that.
He was a member of the Shabak, the Israeli FBI. The Shabak includes both, you know, the equivalent of the FBI and the equivalent of the Secret Service. And he was a senior guy in the Secret Service. After he's away during the assassination, and afterwards he's brought back to kind of rehabilitate the unit. And he, once the video surfaces, and it takes a few weeks, he begins watching it over and over again because he wants to understand all the failures. The obvious ones, which is the fact that Yigal Amir is in there, but where the bodyguards are standing, how they move as Rabin progresses, and so on. We met with him maybe 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And I think Nancy asked him, so when was the last time you saw this film? It being now 20 years later, and he said yesterday.
He said yesterday. He said, I watch it almost every day.
Yeah.
Almost every day.
And just by the way, since the journalism student was also had managed to get into that parking lot and should not have been able to. And he's got his tape recorder running, and he's hoping to ask Rabin a question. He doesn't get a chance to ask Rabin a question, but he goes home thinking, I've got this historical moment on tape. And he gets home and presses play and realizes he had pressed the wrong buttons and he doesn't have it.
So... just in the time, it's 8:15. Do you want to jump ahead to the conspiracy theories?
Yeah.
So there are all these conspiracy theories in Israel about this, much as there are conspiracy theories in our country about the Kennedy assassination. And basically, like, if I can summarize, the conspiracy theories say that Rabin was faking his own death, and that what Rabin wanted was a failed assassination attempt, because that would boost his popularity ratings and boost the popularity of the peace process. And under the scenarios, or under the various scenarios, the way that it lays out is that Yigal Amir was firing blanks. And in fact, somebody yelled blanks or something like it in that moment that people claimed they heard. And that Rabin falls but was not harmed when Yigal Amir shoots.
This is all part of the theory, or one of the theories.
One of the theories. And then many of the theories basically hinge on what happens in the car. Rabin goes into the car, and once they're in the car, something happened. An unnamed conspirator shot Rabin in the stomach, in the front. This is the theory in the conspiracy theories, and that Rabin died from the shot to the front. Now the coroner, the official coroner,
and we heard this again and again. By the way, we went to Jerusalem. We did sort of man on the street interviews, and we heard again and again. Well, everybody knows that Rabin was shot in the front, of course.
Then the coroner, like as you guys report out, like the coroner concluded that he was killed by two bullets to the back, no exit wounds, and there's overwhelming evidence that it was from the gun that Yigal Amir had, and Yigal Amir admitted it. The bullets all match up. The ballistics all match up. And the main piece of evidence for the conspirators is this shirt, is Rabin's shirt and his undershirt. And that you explained to me and we put this on the radio show, that there was a TV special saying that in the shirt, which had been in the National Archive for a decade in Israel, when you look at the shirt and you look at it, there aren't just the two bullet holes in the back, but there's a hole in the front. And in the undershirt, when you line it up, there's another hole, there's a hole in the front of the undershirt as well. And so you were not somebody who had a lot of faith in the conspiracy theories. But no. You got onto the undershirt and shirt beat because...
Well, Rabin's daughter brought the shirt out during an interview. And she's not a conspiracist, obviously. The conspiracy theories tend to come from the right or from the far right. She is not on the right. But even she had some concerns. And I think my position up until that point in working on this book and trying to figure out how to deal with the conspiracy theories was to ignore them. They just felt politically motivated and frankly just silly. You know, the evidence is just overwhelming. Amir has confessed over and over. He's never recanted. But this moment when his daughter brings out the shirt, when Rabin's daughter brings out the shirt,
and she brings it out to say, like, well, there is one thing that makes me think, like, I don't know, like, there's the shirt.
And I have to say that you know, the hole does look small and round the way one would think a bullet hole looked. Certainly it did to me when I stood there in her office. I mean, the two of us kind of stood there and with our mouths open.
She pulls out the shirt in her office, like, lays it out for you, lays out the undershirt.
And puts the undershirt, kind of tucks it into the shirt the way, you know, so it's situated in that way that Rabin would wear it. And you see the two holes lined up.
And she never wanted to get the shirt tested herself because she's a public figure, and she knew that if she even started to get it tested, that it might fuel these conspiracy theories that have her father actually planning his own murder. So
I asked her at some point a few weeks later if I could take the shirt away from Israel, away from the politics, and have it tested in the United States. You know, when a bullet passes through fabric, it leaves traces of copper or lead or soot, and it clings to the fabric forever or for decades, especially if the fabric is man-made. And Rabin's shirt was a Marks & Spencer. I think it was 55 polyester, 45 cotton.
Other way.
45 polyester, 55 cotton.
Glad we cleared that up.
And in the meantime, I had looked for, you know, I had worked in Washington as a national security correspondent, so I knew people in law enforcement, and I asked a lot of people, who is the guy who can do gunshot analysis whose opinion would be unimpeachable? And a couple of people said, you've got to go to Arizona. You've got to go to a town in Arizona called Carefree. You know, population 3,000, and bring the shirt to Luke Haig. Lucian Haig goes by Luke. And so this is the journey. I took the shirt, wrapped it up in my carry-on, in fact, along with the rest of the clothes, because Luke had said over the phone, you know, bring everything. I was very worried that at the airport there would be some ordeal. Security is very intense at Ben-Gurion Airport. I'm sure some of you have been through it. I had a letter from the daughter, from Dahlia, saying you can take the shirt and get it tested.
But you can see, you know, somebody opening up the suitcase and saying, oh, you have a suitcase full of bloody clothing, but you have a letter, so on your way, sir.
I got through security and made it to Arizona and spent a day with Luke in his lab. And he tested the hole very thoroughly. You'll see the video, and then we'll talk about the results.
So this is him with the shirt?
Yeah, and this is me with, I'm apologizing because it's me with an iPhone. So, and I'm not, you know, I'm not very skilled.
The whole family.
Uh-oh. It's a conspiracy.
It's a conspiracy.
Oh, I'm not a psych.
Wait, oh, go no, back,
what,
go back.
What? Yeah.
So this is the shirt he's looking at. That's Luke.
You'll see the hole in a minute. So this is the shirt that's encrusted in blood, and he's measuring the hole now. This is the
it's
front
three
of the
inches over.
Yeah, there it is.
On the center edge. And unfortunately, the shirt's been cut. Most of us would like to go down from the collar because.
Is that it? The black thing?
That's
black
the spot? Microphone. Yeah.
No,
the radio.
No, he got it. It was a spot on the left side at the bottom of the screen.
That.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And you just panned away.
About yeah. 17 inches down.
I did.
The top. And that is an estimate. And 7 3/8 up from the bottom edge.
So for the radio show, we went through 6 hours of that and concluded.
Yeah, and I'll just say, Luke had done, you know, all kinds of things over the years. Ruby Ridge, he reconstructed in his backyard to try to figure out how, you know, what went wrong there. He had worked on re-examining the evidence of the Kennedy assassination for an episode of Nova. And he's also a skeptic. And it's not a bullet hole. That's what he determined. He said, he told me on the phone.
So it's a hole, but it doesn't have the, like, the copper and other things around it that would indicate that it had been made by a bullet.
Right. And he was absolutely sure it's not a bullet hole. He had said all along from the beginning that he could, you know, rule in or rule out bullet hole, but if it's not a bullet, it's very hard to tell what it might be. He had some speculation. He thought maybe it was something that happened on the operating table. Maybe it was a surgical device.
Like they pumped, yeah. They put a hole in his chest or something.
Medical instrument, yeah.
But the bottom line is, not a hole. Rabin was not shot from the front. There was no conspiracy.
Now that the book has come out, is that news in Israel? Because the thought that he shot in the front, it's so popular. People were just saying it to you on the street. People would refer to the hole in the shirt because of this TV special. People knew about it. Is it news in Israel now you've proven that the hole in the shirt actually wasn't a bullet hole?
I think it's not sort of in the way that I guess I anticipated. In other words, so we did an hour-long show about this, and the show was talked about in Israel and in the Israeli press. But I think the conspiracy theories are sort of very strong, and they're strong in part because they are politically motivated. And I think it's hard to tell people when you have ideas about something that are not just based on observation or science, but some, you know, political notion of things, that it's just wrong. And in fact, here's Luke describing, you know, sort of his version of why people tend to believe in conspiracy theories, and he links it to the Kennedy assassination.
I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but I think there's a natural human inclination to want it to be more than that. There's got to be more than just one lone loser with a $13 rifle could kill the president.
Lee Harvey Oswald's rifle apparently cost $12.78. He was rounding up a little bit.
Right, and I think that the analogy fits. I think, you know, for a lot of people, you know, the idea that just this one guy in Israel, this one Jewish extremist, this 25-year-old law student, managed to get close enough to kill Rabin, and, you know, maybe alter the course of history. That it just can't be. It's got to be something larger than that.
Is the reason why that theory is popular on the right because the right doesn't want to feel like one of their own killed the prime minister? It's just unthinkable. Okay, this event brought us to power. This event ended the peace process. We're for all that, but you know, it couldn't have been just like you can't blame us for this kind of.
You're looking at me.
I mean, I think that's true. I think the right felt blamed and blamed collectively. And I think there was, you know, part of the explanation of the conspiracy theories was this way of deflecting blame. Because if Yigal Amir didn't do it, then, you know, whatever incitement or inflammatory rhetoric existed before Rabin or didn't, it's sort of irrelevant, right? It was actually, you know, the Secret Service that was involved, or it was Rabin himself who concocted this plot, you know, that was supposed to raise his popularity. It was supposed to be an assassination attempt that gets thwarted.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much. Dan Efron, Nancy Updike, thank you all for coming out. You'll be signing books. Okay. Thanks to WNYC and to the New York Public Library, to Paul, for having us here today. So books over there.